Chapter 1. Monday, August 28th. The Night Soil Men. It is August 1854, and London is a city of scavengers. Just the names alone read now like some kind of exotic zoological catalogue. Bone pickers, rag gatherers, pure finders, dredgermen, mudlarks, sewer hunters, dustmen, night soil men, bunters, toshers, shoremen. These were the London underclasses, at least 100,000 strong. So immense were their numbers that had the scavengers broken off and formed their own city, it would have been the fifth largest in all of England. But the diversity and precision of their routines were more remarkable than their sheer number. Early risers strolling along the Thames would see the toshers wading through the muck of low tide, dressed almost comically in flowing velveteen coats, their oversized pockets filled with stray bits of copper recovered from the water's edge. The toshers walked with a lantern strapped to their chest to help them see in the pre-dawn gloom, and carried an 8-foot-long pole that they used to test the ground in front of them, and to pull themselves out when they stumbled into a quagmire. The pole and the eerie glow of the lantern through the robes gave them the look of ragged wizards, scouring the foul river's edge for magic coins. Beside them fluttered the mudlarks, often children, dressed in tatters and content to scavenge all the waste that the toshers rejected as below their standards, lumps of coal, old wood, scraps of rope. Above the river, in the streets of the city, the pure finders eked out a living by collecting dog shit, colloquially called pure, while the bone pickers foraged for carcasses of any stripe. Below ground, in the cramped but growing network of tunnels beneath London's streets, the sewer hunters slogged through the flowing waste of the metropolis. Every few months, an unusually dense pocket of methane gas would be ignited by one of their kerosene lamps, and the hapless soul would be incinerated 20 feet below ground in a river of raw sewage. The scavengers, in other words, lived in a world of excrement and death. Dickens began his last great novel, Our Mutual Friend, with a father-daughter team of toshers stumbling across a corpse floating in the Thames, whose coins they solemnly pocket. "What world does a dead man belong to?" the father asks rhetorically, when chided by a fellow tosher for stealing from a corpse. "T'other world. What world does money belong to? This world." The city was vast, even by today's standards, with 2.5 million people crammed inside a 30-mile circumference. But most of the techniques for managing that kind of population density that we now take for granted, recycling centers, public health departments, safe sewage removal, hadn't been invented yet. And so the city itself improvised a response, an unplanned organic response, to be sure, but at the same time, a response that was precisely contoured to the community's waste removal needs. As the garbage and excrement grew, an underground market for refuse developed, with hooks into established trades. Specialists emerged, each dutifully carting goods to the appropriate site in the official market. The bone collectors selling their goods to the bone boilers, the pure finders selling their dog shit to tanners, who used the pure to rid their leather goods of the lime they had soaked in for weeks to remove animal hair. A process widely considered to be, as one tanner put it, the most disagreeable in the whole range of manufacture. We're naturally inclined to consider these scavengers tragic figures, and to fulminate against a system that allowed so many thousands to eke out a living by foraging through human waste. In many ways, this is the correct response. It was, to be sure, the response of the great crusaders of the age, among them Dickens and Mayhew. But such social outrage should be accompanied by a measure of wonder and respect. Without any central planner coordinating their actions, without any education at all, This itinerant underclass managed to conjure up an entire system for processing and sorting the waste generated by 2 million people. The great contribution, usually ascribed to Mayhew's London labor, is simply his willingness to see and record the details of these impoverished lives. But just as valuable was the insight that came out of that bookkeeping, once he had run the numbers. Far from being unproductive vagabonds, Mayhew discovered these people were actually performing an essential function for their community. The removal of the refuse of a large town, he wrote, is perhaps one of the most important of social operations, and the scavengers of Victorian London weren't just getting rid of that refuse, they were recycling it. No extended description of London from that period failed to mention the stench of the city. Some of that stench came from the burning of industrial fuels, but the most objectionable smells, the ones that ultimately helped prod an entire public health infrastructure into place, came from the steady, relentless work of bacteria decomposing organic matter. Those deadly pockets of methane in the sewers were themselves produced by the millions of microorganisms diligently recycling human dung into a microbial biomass, with a variety of gases released as waste products. You can think of those fiery underground explosions as a kind of skirmish between two different kinds of scavenger, sewer hunter versus bacterium, living on different scales, but nonetheless battling for the same territory. The opposition between civilization and barbarism was practically as old as the walled city itself. As soon as there were gates, there were barbarians ready to storm them. But Engels and Dickens suggested a new twist, that the advance of civilization produced barbarity as an unavoidable waste product, as essential to its metabolism as the gleaming spires and cultivated thought of polite society. The barbarians weren't storming the gates. They were being bred from within. Marx took that insight, wrapped it in Hegel's dialectics, and transformed the 20th century. But the idea itself sprang out of a certain kind of lived experience, on the ground, as the activists still like to say. It came in part from seeing human beings buried in conditions that defiled both the dead and the living. But in one crucial sense, Dickens and Engels had it wrong. However gruesome the site of the burial ground was, the corpses themselves were not likely spreading malignant diseases. The stench was offensive enough, but it was not infecting anyone. A mass grave of decomposing bodies was an affront to both the senses and to personal dignity, but the smell it emitted was not a public health risk. No one died of stench in Victorian London, but tens of thousands died because the fear of stench blinded them to the true perils of the city and drove them to implement a series of wrong-headed reforms that only made the crisis worse. Dickens and Engels were not alone. Practically the entire medical and political establishment fell into the same deadly error. Everyone from Florence Nightingale to the pioneering reformer Edwin Chadwick to the editors of The Lancet to Queen Victoria herself. The history of knowledge conventionally focuses on breakthrough ideas and conceptual leaps. But the blind spots on the map, the dark continents of error and prejudice, carry their own mystery as well. How could so many intelligent people be so grievously wrong for such an extended period of time? How could they ignore so much overwhelming evidence that contradicted their most basic theories? These questions, too, deserve their own discipline, the sociology of error.